continue now with our ongoing tale of how Rav Baruch, the father of the Alter Rebbe, became a chosid of the Baal Shem Tov. You'll recall that he is being told a story by Rav Yitzchok Shol, the smithy, by whom he is spending the last Pesach before his chasna. We left in the middle of the story about an individual, Getzel Shloim by name, who seemed to be a most strange duck, a person who made his living by begging and going from door to door, and if people would give him something, he would, by way of thanks, say Shema Yisrael. If, on the other hand, he received nothing, he also would say Shema Yisrael. In Shul, the only thing he was ever heard to say was Shema Yisrael. And so Getzel Shloimeh was looked upon as somebody who was a half-wit. Once, when Getzel Shloimeh felt that he was nearing his end, he called the Chevra Kadisha and asked them to bury him in the worst part of the cemetery, but they should start a new shul, a new row for him. And this greatly puzzled the gravediggers, wondering where did he think he would be buried otherwise? And why does he want a new row? Before he passed away, Getzel Shloimeh also gave them a basket which was filled with manuscripts, and they had no idea what it was. And here it's the time of Levaya, and Rabbi Nachman Yitzchok, who always made it a practice to attend all Levayas Mishkayidin Gedacht, whether of important or unimportant Jews, when he heard of poor Getzel Shloimeh's Levaya, he asked that he be given notice of the exact time of the funeral so that he could attend. When Rabbi Nachman Yitzchok arrived at the funeral, the shamus, the sexton who was given the basket with the manuscripts or documents or whatever they were, came up to Rabbi Nachman Yitzchok and told him that Getzel Shloimeh had given this to him before dying and had asked that it be buried with him. The sexton wanted the Rav's confirmation that it would be in order to do as the dying man had requested. Rav Nachman Yitzchok took the basket with the papers and examined them, and to his great astonishment, he found that they were accounts which Getzel Shloimeh had kept for years. He scrutinized them all and discovered that they represented the sums of money which the beggar Getzel Shloimeh had collected every day. All the money had been accounted for by Getzel Shloimeh, showing that he had distributed the money among poor and needy people, but such people who felt too proud to stretch out their hands to ask for help. And so Getzel Shloimeh saved them from this shame and embarrassment by doing the begging himself in order to be able to provide them with their needs. According to these carefully kept accounts, Getzel Shloimeh had not kept a penny of the money for himself. Rav Nachman Yitzchok immediately made it known that from that day onward, Getzel Shloimeh should be referred to as the Venerable Getzel Shloimeh, for he was obviously a great Jew. Notice was sent around to all the surrounding towns and villages to find his son Chaim Shmuel and to inform him of his father's passing. Meanwhile, the Rav himself undertook to say Kaddish for the soul of the departed pauper, whom he now knew had been a tzaddik nister, a hidden righteous individual. It was 2 years before Chaim Shmuel, who we remember had left the town at 14, wandering in order to make a living, and had by now been over 30 years of age, had married, and so on, had learned of his father's death, and that was when he came with his family and settled in Harki. Chaim Shmuel had rented lodgings on the outskirts of the town where the rent was cheaper, for though he worked hard to make a living by traveling in the surrounding villages, he barely managed to make ends meet. In fact, he was a very poor man. And to add to his misfortune, he had a horror of a wife who nagged at him incessantly. And, as if his cup of trouble were not full enough, his children all died at an early age. Yet never a word of complaint passed the lips of this unfortunate man. He accepted everything as God's will, and did not think of it questioning anything that he decreed. On the contrary, like a true tzaddik, he thanked God for the bad as well as the good. It never occurred to Chaim Shmuel to take advantage of the fact that he was the son of the now recognized tzaddik Nister, Getzel Shlema. The Jews of Harki used to go to Getzel Shlema's grave. They revered his memory so much. But Chaim Shmuel lived so unobtrusively on the outskirts of the town and was absent so much in his search for a living that was a case seemingly of out of sight, out of mind, and no one gave him a thought. There was an exception, however, and this was Avram Mendel, one of the secret chassidim who often, together with his friend Rabbi Israel Yosef, visited the Heilige Baal Shem Tov, the Baal Shem Tov of Meshebesh. Avram Mendel knew Chaim Shmuel from the days when he lived in a village, for the former often used to travel about in towns and villages on his secret missions of the Baal Shem Tov. But despite the fact that he kept a superficial eye on Chaim Shmuel, Avram Mendel had no conception of the trials and troubles that had beset his path in the course of the years, and which had proved his worthiness. And so it came as somewhat of a surprise to him when on that particular visit he made to Meshebesh with Rabbi Israel Yosef, the Baal Shem Tov gave him the assignment of seeking out Chaim Shmuel and bringing him into the ranks of Hasidim. Chaim Shmuel is a man with a hoicha neshama, with a lofty soul, said the Baal Shem Tov, apart from the fact that he is the son of a Nister. He is the Gilgul, the reincarnation of one who in a former life did not complete the work of charity as was due. He has therefore been sent on this earth to make good this lack. As you are aware, he is a man who has suffered much in poverty and family troubles. Yet he has never complained, and despite many temptations, he has always kept on the right path. It has therefore been decreed in heaven that he now become wealthy and live a new life which he richly deserves, and which he will certainly make the best use of. The Baal Shem Tov gave Avram Mendel instructions to take Chaim Shmuel in hand, make him a member of the secret group of Hasidim and Harki, and teach him Torah and Kabbalah. This seemed quite in order, but when Avram Mendel came to Chaim Shmuel and told him the Baal Shem Tov's wishes, Chaim Shmuel was filled with joy and eagerness. He threw himself heart and soul into these studies and made remarkable progress. Materially also, he improved vastly, and before long he was so successful that he became a rich man. He began to distribute charity with an open hand, and his generosity knew no bounds. To everyone's surprise, they now found that he was also a scholar. In his new circumstances, he began to play an important role in the Jewish life of the city. He was now looked upon with a new respect, and everybody now called him Reb Chaim Shmuel. Chaim Shmuel remained a member of the secret group of Chassidim and Harki for 5 years, during which time he had paid several visits to the Baal Shem Tov of Meshebesh. Nobody knew of these trips, nor, in fact, did anybody know of the existence of the Hasidic group in Harki, for it was still conducted secretly. The time had not yet become ripe for its revelations. The story of the manner in which this secret group was brought to the public notice was due to chance, connected with something that happened to Pesach the Frenchman, as he was called in Harki, and it certainly was a most unusual and remarkable story. Harki belonged to one of the Polish princes of the Radziwill family. This prince very rarely showed himself in these parts, spending most of his time in France. His estates just outside Harki were very valuable, including large forests which stretched out for miles. One of these young noblemen of the Radziwill family was named Benedict. He had a very good friend in France named Pierre Louis, who came from an assimilated Jewish family, had no connection with any Jews, and barely knew of his own Jewish origin. Benedict married into the princely Russian family Dimitrov, who owned large estates in Russia and palaces in Moscow. When he settled on the estates of his wife's family, he brought his young friend of Jewish descent with him, as they were inseparable. There Pierre Louis married the daughter of a high official, and he and his friend Benedict lived a life of pleasure and luxury. When Pierre Louis was 55 years of age, he became a widower, and finding himself completely without ties, threw himself entirely into a whirlwind of gaiety and orgies of drunkenness, which at that time was the life of the Russian and Polish princess. Kharkiv was surrounded by many large forests, and so Benedict chose one of his estates there to house his hunting parties. He and his friends came there twice a year, in the summer and winter, and Pierre Louis was always in the party. They had a great time hunting there, and there always followed lavish and extravagant parties where there was much drinking and merrymaking. Pierre Louis was in the forefront both in hunting and in celebrating, at which all the squires, noblemen, and princes from all the surrounding estates were invited. Nobody knew of Pierre Louis's Jewish origin, and by now he too had forgotten all about it. Once, when Yitzchok Scholl's father of Nissen was on a visit to the Baal Shem Tov, the Baal Shem Tov said to him, "It is written, Yerde Hayom Ba'anius, those who go down in the sea in ships, Oisei Meloch, then do their work in raging water." The word Ania can be translated as ship, and also from Tania Vania as a lament. The phrase, "those that go down to the sea," refers to the souls that come down and enter the bodies, comparable to the seas which cover everything, as the body covers the divine soul within it. There are two kinds of descent. There is descent of the ship into the sea. This is the sea of life, regulated, definite, like one who finds himself in a circle of Torah scholars and fine men. There is also a different kind of Yerde Hayam, descent into the sea, and that is as if one is there in the midst of it without any ship for refuge, awaiting calamity. Just so is a Jewish soul, which is in an un-Jewish environment, removed from the atmosphere of Torah scholars. Therefore, there are other Jewish souls who do their work in raging waters, whose duty it is to save these souls who are floundering hopelessly in a non-Jewish atmosphere, in the same way as a drowning man at the mercy of the tempestuous sea. At first, Rav Nissen did not understand the purpose of the Baal Shem Tov's exposition, but it was soon made known to him that the Tzaddik had in mind none other than the Christianized friend of Benedict, Pierre Louis. Rav Nissen now heard for the first time that Pierre Louis was a Jew, and that his real name was Pesach Tzvi, after his mother's grandfather, who had been a great scholar and a God-fearing Jew, notwithstanding the fact that his father was very much the reverse. "During the coming winter," said the Baal Shem Tov to Rav Nissen, "Benedict Radzivill will go hunting in the forests around Kharkiv with his friend Pierre Louis. They will both visit Kharkiv, and on the second day after their arrival, I want you to open this envelope and read the instructions contained. You are to carry out all the directions." The Baal Shem Tov then instructed Rav Nissen to go to Pierre Louis and tell him that he was of Jewish descent, that his name was really Pesach Tzvi, after his mother's grandfather, Pierre being the French name for Pesach, and Louis for Levi, for he was a Levi. Baal Shem Tov told his disciple that if Pierre Louis did not wish to listen to what he had to tell him, he must nevertheless go to him daily during the time he was in Kharkiv and repeat what the Baal Shem Tov had disclosed about him, exactly as written in the instructions given. Naturally, it all had to be done in secret. The Baal Shem Tov assured Rav Nissen that he would succeed in his mission. During the hunting season, when Benedict Radzivill and his friends were in the Kharkiv district, the whole town buzzed with activity. All the shopkeepers, who for weeks anticipated the visit of the aristocracy, had prepared their wares, stocking up with the goods they already knew from experience would be approved by the noblemen and their families. And, as had been said, these hunting parties included the squires and noblemen from all the surrounding districts, so there's quite a large clientele. When Reb Nissen returned home to Harki from his visit to Mezhebish, Harki was putting on its best appearance in readiness for the coming hunters. It was the practice of Benedict Radziwill to come into Harki with his friend Pierre Lewis as soon as they arrived for the hunting party. They would then remain in the town for a day or two, arrange a banquet of welcome for the squires of the district, who would return with them to Benedict's hunting lodge. When the hunting was over, and the celebrations too, Benedict and Pierre Lewis returned to Harki to prepare for their further trip, for from there they were to travel to Moscow. On this particular occasion, as on every other occasion when they visited the Harki, they stayed at the home of the local priest. But as Benedict was about to enter the priest's house this time, he tripped over the threshold and fell heavily. He always carried a revolver in his hip pocket, and thus it happened that as he fell, the revolver went off, shooting a bullet into his stomach. A confusion arose as everyone dashed forward to lend assistance. Benedict was always accompanied on his hunting trips by a doctor, and he was with him now, but try as he would to stop the bleeding, the blood refused to stop. The wounded man lay in pain, his temperature mounting with fever. Riders were dispatched to bring doctors from the surrounding towns, for it was obvious that the patient's condition was becoming steadily worse. The Jews of Harki were very distressed at the news of the accident to Benedict Radziwill, for he was regarded by them as a good-hearted man, always friendly to the Jews. When Rav Nissen heard what had happened, he realized the time had come to look into the Baal Shem Tov's letter of instructions. To his astonishment, he found that the letter contained a prescription on how to treat such a wound as Benedict had just received. And as a postscript, Rav Nissen was told that if he would be asked for an assurance as to where he had obtained this medical knowledge, he should reply that it came from a Jew in Volin, whose name was Rabbi Yisrael Baal Shem Tov. It was also written there that if the nobleman wanted to reward him with money, he should refuse, saying his reward would be sufficient if he would promise to be good to the Jews and give them the means of earning their livelihood. It was actually on the second day, as Benedict lay unconscious with an ever-rising fever, the doctors practically having given up hope of saving him, that Reb Nissen arrived at the priest's house, saying that he had brought a remedy for the sick man. When Pierre Lewis beheld Rabbi Nissen, a Jew in a long capote with a long beard and payas, he burst out laughing, and would have driven him out had it not been for Benedict's doctor, who was so desperate he was ready to listen to anyone who came along with an offer of a cure. Thus Rabbi Nissen was admitted to the patient, and with the help of the doctor, spread an ointment over the body of the sick man. He also forced some drops of medicine down his throat, and about an hour later, Benedict opened his eyes. His fever had abated, and his wound was beginning to close. Everybody looked on incredulously, but with great relief. It was only then Reb Nissen asked Pierre Lewis to go with him into another room, as he had something private and important to discuss with him. "Listen," he said to him when they were alone in the room, "I want you to know that you are a Jew, and that your real name is Pesach Tzvi, after your mother's grandfather. Till now, you have followed a wrong path. From today onwards, you should return to your people and to your God." Saying which, Reb Nissen left, and Pierre Lewis was too dumbfounded to utter a word. On the third day, Benedict was already well enough to sit in a chair. He asked that Reb Nissen be sent for, and when he arrived, he welcomed him and asked him where he obtained this miraculous cure that had saved his life. Reb Nissen then disclosed the secret of the Baal Shem Tov, his teachings, and what he stood for. That is how it became known that the Baal Shem Tov was preaching a new way of life, and that he had a secret group of Hasidic followers in the Harki itself, also who these followers were. Radziel recovered so completely within a few days that he was able to leave Harki in company with Pierre Louis. It was already the month of Nisan when the latter suddenly made an unexpected appearance in Harki. He immediately made his way to Abnissan. Looking very serious and subdued, he said to him, "Ever since the day I left Harki, I've been restless and ill at ease. My stomach just turned against eating anything trefa, and I have not known any peace. I have an overwhelming urge to return to Jews and Judaism. I told my secret to my dear friend Benedict Radziwill, and he was very sympathetic and understanding. He advised me to follow the dictates of my heart, and much as he would feel the wrench of our parting, he said I ought to return to my people and would not allow any other consideration to stand in my way." Abnissan offered to do all he could to help him in his resolve. He recommended that he take lessons to learn how to read Ivra, to read Hebrew, and also how to say the brachas that a Jew must know, and that he take these lessons from an intelligent young Jew who also knew Russian and Polish. Pesach Tzvi made such excellent progress that within a year he was already well advanced in Chumash. On that particular Pesach, the Jewish squire Lipiborach, who, as we had learned, had returned in Tshuva to the Jewish fold, and that was one of the stories that we told much earlier, and which Yitzchok Shol had told, took the old Rav and his former teacher of Nachman Yitzchok, sat them in his carriage, led by four horses, and set off for the river to get water for matzah baking, from Mayim Shalonu. Pesach Tzvi also went with him. He was eagerly looking forward to carrying out this mitzvah for the first time. He put on his leather leggings, which he had used for hunting, and supporting the arm of the old Rav, who walked along the plank over the river, waded into the water to help him draw a pail of this mitzvah water. Pesach Tzvi had found true happiness in his return to his people. He was comfortably settled on the estate just outside Harki, which his friend Benedict had given to him as a present. Benedict had also shown his goodwill towards the Jews by presenting them with the land on which their houses were built. And now we have the story of how the secret of the Hasidic group in Harki and of the wonderful powers of their leader, the Baal Shem Tov, came to be revealed. This story, told in all its drama by Yitzchok Shol, held Baruch spellbound. The Meshaleb, Yitzchok Shol's brother-in-law, acquired such a thirst for every bit of information about Hasidism and its founder that he bombarded his young brother-in-law with endless questions. He was now convinced that here was a great movement with a great ideal. Meshaleb now experienced a feeling of estrangement towards his older brother-in-law, Rav Zalman Meir, who remained unmoved despite all he had heard, and remained the typical scholar who refuses to allow himself to be influenced by anything at all, only wishing to continue with his Torah studies. The festival of Pesach, which Baruch had spent at the home of Eliezer Reuven, the smith of Debrumzel, was at an end. The two older sons-in-law had left for their yeshivas, where they were teachers. The smith's son, Shmuel Nochem, had departed. On the advice of his brothers-in-law, as well as of the dying of Debrumzel, and armed with letters of recommendation by them, he had set off to Vitebsk, where he entered the yeshiva there. The dying had been astonished at the unbelievable change in Shmuel Nochem, and at the wonderful progress he had made in his studies while at the Dubrovnik Yeshiva. Baruch would have liked to have given a letter for Shmuel Nochem to take with him too, as his brother-in-law Rabbi Yosef Yitzchok was in Vitebsk, but he did not yet wish to make his whereabouts known to him or his sister, nor did he want them to be inquiring as to what he was doing and how he was managing. Everyone had left except the youngest son-in-law Yitzchok Shol, who the day immediately after Yontov was over, returned to his work and the smithy. Baruch, who had heard and seen so much this particular Pesach during his stay at the smith's, betook himself to the field outside the town, and settling himself under the shade of a tree, became lost in his thoughts. Baruch had often resorted to this spot when he wanted to think deeply. On this occasion, his thoughts were completely taken up on the subject of Hasidism. Rabbi Yitzchok Shol had made an indelible impression upon him with his Hasidic stories, which came forth like a bubbling spring at which Baruch drank to quench his thirst. Baruch could listen to him endlessly and sought every opportunity of learning all he could from him about the Baal Shem Tov and all the other great figures of Hasidus. Yisroel Chol, however, was not very accessible these days. His patent of a new gadget attached to the old type of plowing shears had brought in and was continuing to bring in increasing business. They had engaged two assistants, but there was more than enough work to keep them all busy. And the smith himself, Eliezer Reuven, had gone away for a few days. There was an additional reason for Yitzchok Shul being so fully occupied, for he was secretly busy on a new invention, namely an improved machine for breaking up the soil after it had been plowed up. The old type of implement had wooden blades set in iron, and these could not cut very deeply into the soil, nor effectively break up the soil, as did this improved invention of Yitzchok Shul's. His newer implement had iron blades which broke up the soil into smaller pieces and cut deeper into the earth because of certain heavy metal weights which he had fixed on them. Yitzchok Shul had kept the secret of this new invention of his even from his father-in-law, and now that he had gone away for a few days, Yitzchok Shul took the opportunity of trying it out on the fields of a peasant farmer who was a customer of theirs. The farmer was delighted with the results, and word flew around that the smith's son-in-law had a new invention which was simply wonderful. Peasants from all over began flocking in to see the wonder machine in action and to place their orders. Baruch was left completely to his own devices and made use of the time to wander off to the fields and dream and think in solitude. And he certainly had plenty to think about, and all of it was now circled around Chassidus. Baruch found himself going over the explanation that Shmuel Nochem had given the name of the Baal Shem Tov on the first mission of Bava Metzia of Shnayim Eichsim Betalus, two people holding on to a talus. Shmuel Nochem had heard it from Shalom Yechiel of Harki, who had heard it from Azriel Yosef, the latter having heard it from the lips of the Baal Shem Tov himself. Baal Shem Tov declared that the following revelation came directly from Shemayim. In everything that the Almighty creates on this earth, there is a divine spark. Thus, when a man does a mitzvah, a divine spark shoots forth and reaches back to its heavenly source. The doer of the mitzvah reaps his full reward. But when two people share the mitzvah, the reward for it is divided between them. If one of them has sinned, and someone comes along and brings the sinner back onto the right path, both share in the reward. Thus decrees the Mishnah too, that when two people are holding a talus, both saying, "It is mine," that means both claiming credit for helping the neshama back on its path, the talus, the neshama, the reward for bringing it back, must be divided between them. Baruch learned from this that it is a duty of everyone to try to help every Jew who had wandered from the righteous path, and however many should participate in this noble work, there is a reward enough for them all. When Yitzchok Shul finished his work at the smithy, he threw off his working clothes and sat down to study with much zeal. Baruch took the opportunity to listen to him and was fortunate enough to hear some more about Hasidim and the history of its development. He told him at great length the story of another Baruch V'Yazner. And this is a lengthy story, and we will relate it to Mirza Shem in installments at a later time. But Mirza Shem, next time we get back to the Baruch, the father of the Alter Rebbe, and his continuing journey after Pesach at the home of the smithy.